Those of you who weren't with us last week, last session, must remember that we began the wedding process, which should take us not only tonight, but also in Yitz Hashem next time that we work. We finished with the Shidduch, the concept, the validity of a Shadchan, the need for it, historical reasoning behind it, so that all that is behind us. If you want to bring two organizations together, and in this case it is two familial organizations, and you want to start a new enterprise, and in this case the enterprise is another generation, your daughter, my son, my daughter, your son, whatever the case may be, then obviously there have to be certain understandings between us. Let's get to know one another. Now that occurs after Shidduch has been agreed upon. You may have heard someone say, oh, there's going to be a Vort. Vort is the Yiddish for word. Word meaning some oral conversations or discussions of getting to know you. The Vort is the beginning of a procedure which would generally result either on the spot or within a given amount of time in another term that you have heard, and that is Tenoyim. Tenoyim literally means conditions. Starting with the Vort, which is an oral getting to know you, ending with Tenoyim, which is a written document of understanding between us, two families decide to merge. Or as we say in Yiddish, to become mechutanim. Where will the children live? Where won't they live? Where won't they live? Also, hold on. Let me give you some of the things. The bedroom set, the dining room set, a house, an apartment, school, we'll pay for it, work, whatever it is. Pardon me? Well, these are amenities. These are amenities which have already become a kind of expected norm, just like one expects to see the bride in a white gown. I can tell you for a fact that in the so-called yeshivish circles, there is a whole, as I say, expected amenities. But don't get so crazy about it, because if you'll get engaged, I'm sure, or if someone will get engaged, I'm sure you expect her to have a diamond ring. I mean, for what reason? But the world, you understand? No, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. There are those exceptions. But I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. However, these expectations have developed over the year. You say a watch. Remember, we spoke, or we will yet have to speak, about other expectations, which again are almost understood, are presupposed. The Kala gives the Chassan a talis bag. The father-in-law gives, the father-in-law-to-be gives a talis. And right now it's called a Chassan Ashas, a 20-volume Gemara. The bride side, you see. And, you know, you're pushing the watch. You push the watch. There's no question about it that this is America of the 20th century. It's called the Chosenzeger. That's what they're calling it. Yeah, that's right. Now let me tell you what it is. It's not a Seiko. It's not a Seiko. And it's not a Timex. It is, you go into the east side, you go into Tournau, you know, Tournau Plaza over there, and you get yourself a 24 carat solid gold watch. You understand? But you see, the expectation is such today that it's called a chosenzeger. You know, these things are not new. All of these things have some kind of historical background. Now, right over here, you got to stop. You see, you're in big business. You here are in a league of big business. You are talking about the amalgamation, the merger, the creation of a new organizational unit, which has tremendous amount of monetary substance to it, each on his and her own status, each to his and her own preference. Therefore, you can well imagine the legitimacy of what we call tenoim, and that is, let's talk, let's see if we can agree on something, and once we get to know one another orally, the vort, it will continue, a second session, maybe a third session, informal conversations, we'll send representatives, my daughter, your son, you know, things like that, let the kids hack it out, and then ultimately it resolves itself in a document called Tanoim. Let me tell you something about Tanoim. If you go to the Jewish Museum, you probably will yet be able to see a magnificent display of ancient, and when I say ancient, I mean a good couple of hundred years old, ancient Tanoim and Ksuas. There are some Tanoim there. And they are as long as my hand. Why? Not because the document contains such lengthy details, but the conditions that the families obligated themselves to were all spelled out. You know, the European system of kest, a young fellow would get married, and for the first two, three, whatever years, father-in-law wanted him to sit and learn. So the father-in-law would finance him. What was the reason for it? Oh, yes, the learning was absolutely critical and essential. But this was a kind of transition period. You took a young chassan, 18, 19. He had to first start to learn how to live. So if you can relieve the economic pressures or having to get out into the economic market and those pressures from the young fellow and the young couple, and probably, as we say in Yiddish, the zivig vet oile yofe zayn, it will take off properly. The relationship will take off properly. Well, there is tremendous sociology that is attached and that has to be understood with every one of these things. What happens today? Probably we are not as pedantic and we are not as formal in our conversations most of the time. We probably focus, people such as ourselves would focus on, well, does he love her? Does she love him? Are they decent people? We don't have any criminals over there in the other side of the family. Then let's go. Everything else will kind of work out. But it doesn't always happen that way, because there are still hefty numbers of families that will sit down and discuss and what's more, stipulate all of these things. I've had to adjudicate and step into the middle where one side said, my son's going to be at my table for Pesach. He comes to me for the Siddurim. That's it. And the jerk of a father, in other words, a grandfather-to-be, okay? The jerk of a father didn't realize how he was jeopardizing his position vis-a-vis the entire shidduch. I had to adjudicate it in some which way. He wanted to put it down in paper. He never wanted to go back on it. That was it. Now, I'm not talking, you know, I don't want to apologize for my use of calling him that name, but he's a very substantial individual. He's got all of his marbles, recognized in his field as a certainly a successful product of his particular professional line, But I hate to tell you, if he was sitting here, I'd call him the same jerk that I called him when I was arguing with him. Call him a couple of other things also. Nonetheless, this is what goes on. Now, if you don't have that problem, wonderful. But if you do have that problem, so it's my job to tell you that within this life cycle of marrying off kids, it is real and definitely exists, without question. Therefore, Tanoim. You start with the Vort, talking, discussing, you end up with Tanoim. As far as Tanoim are concerned, which literally again means conditions, there are three prevalent practices as far as the writing of Tanoim. The first practice says, well, let's do our discussions, your side of the family, my side of the family, and I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 8 months, whatever it is, 6 months, 2 months before the wedding, everything will be discussed and decided. Let's sit down, we'll drink a l'chaim, we'll invite some friends from your side, from my side, and we'll write out the Tanoim. We'll write out simply saying that you and I, you representing one side, the chas, and I representing the other side, the kala, have agreed on the following stipulations. Number one, the wedding is going to be on or about this and this date. Number two, clothing. Number three, furniture. Number four, housing. Number five, immediate location or relocation of the chasen and kala. Agreed? Let's shake on it, the Jewish handshake, which is with a sudar, which is a handkerchief or some item that passes between us. And let's have the two witnesses, the two Adim, sign. That's one way. There are great problems with that first way. Because over the years, if God forbid something goes wrong, there was such a social stigma to the breaking of those Tanoim. And boy, they were broken. I'll soon prove it to you in a moment. That people started to fear entering into Tanoim. The social stigma was that if you break one of the Tanoim, and ultimately, as a result of this, the wedding is going to be canceled. You want to know something? I already made an investment. I started to buy my kids what I promised. I paid for it. I commissioned a carpenter, gave him a deposit. He went ahead and ordered the wood and all the material, and he expects to sell the thing because you are causing me a tremendous financial loss. So, in this first type of Tanoim, there was always a third party called an Orev Kablon, and that is a financial guarantor, an underwriter, an insurance broker, who would be ready and willing to pay damages in case I broke and you suffered the damages. And I got so angry with you that you couldn't get a penny out of me. So you then went to the insurance underwriter at this loss, at this disaster, and said, Orev Kablon, insurance underwriter, you go ahead and pay me. Here are my damages. I want $13,000 for all the things that I ordered, and now I don't need. Now you can well imagine that the insurance underwriter is a member of the family, is known to the one who broke the shidduch. Good. So the Orev Kablon is going to pay out. No, you'll pay out $13,000. You're not going to come to me and ask me for it. You imagine what goes on with such things. It's incredible. Those things aren't so evident today. And therefore, this first minhag of Tanoim has been retained only by the infinitesimal minority of those who insist on maintaining a tradition that has existed from time immemorial. And so we come to the second kind of Tanoim. The second kind of Tanoim says, look, let's discuss everything orally. We'll agree on everything. And then we'll sit down at the wedding, you know, when the bride is in the smorgasbord room and the chassan is in the other room, and we'll sit down 25 minutes before the chuppah, half an hour before the chuppah, and we will write to Noam. And we'll put in that we've, you know, kind of discussed everything, and we'll put in generalities and whatever. We'll go through the motions, but 20 minutes before the wedding, so that in case anything happens, at least let it just be oral, let it not be a written document. It's so much different when people agree orally and when people put it into writing. Okay? So there's a problem with that. It's called phony frumkeit. Okay? It is a meaningless document. It is a totally meaningless document. Because the intent of Tanoim was to protect everyone, and not only to protect everyone, to put your mouth where your money wants to be, and whatever you expect to do for the young couple, you're going to do, and you're ready, surely you're ready to put it down in writing. So why go through something which doesn't have ritual meaning, you know, like a lulav and esrog, like Kiddush, but has legal validity, but is totally without meaning anymore? Because 20 minutes before the wedding, whatever you promised, Natalie, you did already, and whatever I promised, I did, and the kids are getting married, so v'sak-sak-kop, what are we going to write to Noyim for? Just because you remember that by your bubba they wrote to Noyim once upon a time. Good, but it has such difficult meaning. No, it isn't like a bracha levatola, a useless or senseless bracha where Shem Hashem is mentioned. It's not that. But whom are you kidding? Just to go through the, you know, the stages of things? It just doesn't make any sense. I'm sorry, what? Again, because people are doing it in that sense, because after all, it's nice. We did it from generations to time immemorial. Let's do it. All right. Better. Let's do it. The more Jewish that we can push into the wedding, the better off it is. Pardon me? Yes, because let me clearly indicate. No, let me clearly indicate something to you. The pushing of it is part, in my humble estimation, is part of a general push in the last, let's say, 20 years to be able to firmly fix that weddings be according to a certain Torah style and flavor that we inherited over there. Now, rabbis are generally not involved in any of the arrangements. Neither with the caterer, neither with the photographer, neither with the flowers, neither with the dress that the caller is going to wear, or what the bridesmaids are going to wear, and so on and so forth. So somehow there was this, you know, this counterforce to try to, and we've succeeded, Baruch Hashem, over the last 20, 25 years, to recreate the chuppah that used to be, and the wedding procedure that used to be, because there's such a tremendous amount of validity to it. However, here in approach number two, though Tanoim could be valid even 20 minutes before the chuppah, to put down all of these moot points created a problem, without question. In addition to this situation of this, you know, the going through the whole document with a moot point, in addition, this fear that has been generated from generation to generation, that you never break Tanoim. You just never break Tanoim, and I still didn't tell you why. You know, so better let's not even touch it. There must be something extraordinarily touchy or dangerous with Tanoim. I don't even want it. Which was not the case. I will yet owe you, and some of you please remind me, that I've got to tell you why this taboo about breaking Tanoim. But let's come to the third approach, and that's the third approach that I put into your hands. Oh, about 20 or 25 years ago, maybe a little more, Rav Moshe Feinstein, no, I think I'm right, Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote this document. Some laughed at it. Why? Because it wasn't the traditional text of the Tanoim. Not only that, it completely did away from another perspective altogether with the need to write Tanoim, because it says absolutely nothing. There is no legal detail in there except for one, and it's nothing more than a romantic, beautiful lovely document. Let's read it first, then I'll comment on it. You can see within the box that there should be, you should be able to define six parts. The first part, around the word Mazel Tov, the big Mazel Tov, is nothing more than poetic introduction. Then you have a double line which separates that poetic introduction, which is nothing more than decoration, from the excuse me, the beginning of the Tanoim, which begins with the words Hamagid Mereshis Acharis. And if you go down and count six lines, at the end of the sixth line, you will see a curlicue that ends the first one, a design curlicue. That's the, you know, that's the second part, let's say. But the first part, it's actually the first section of the true Tanoim. The next section ends three lines later, again with a curlicue of a design, a little shorter. The next section has still a shorter curlicue. It ends the section. Then each one is three lines. Count another three lines, and then you see again a curlicue, and finally the bottom part. Okay, so it's part by part. And let me tell you what's going on in the Mazel Tov over there. To the right of the Mazel Tov, Ya'alevi Yitzmach Kegan Ratuv. Nothing more than heavy poetry, heavy symbolism. Ya'alevi Yitzmach, may it blossom and grow, Kegan Ratuv, like an irrigated field. Okay, what? The relationship. Under that, Matzai Isha Vatov. When you find a woman, Vatov, you will find all good. Go to the left of the Mazel Tov. V'yafek, on the first line, V'yafek Ratzon Me'atov U'metiv. May this be blessed with the stamp of approval of Hatov V'hametiv, the one who is good and who does good, in other words, God. Ha'omer La'devek Tov, when he says that this union, this joint, devek is glue, this bringing together is nothing more than Tov. What did we say? Mazel Tov. That's all we said was Mazel Tov. May everything go well. And we said it in such heavy poetry. But that's the way you do it. Nothing but the best for Romeo and Juliet. You get Shakespeare to write it. Okay? So we begin the actual text itself, the big hey, Hamagid Mereshit Acharit. The only one who can tell at the beginning what's going to be at the end, you know who that is. It's not a computer. It's Ribono Shel Olam. God. Hu yitein shem tov u'sheiris. Let him give good foundation and lasting reputation, l'divrei habris v'hatenaim, to the conditions of this covenant, bris, this agreement, v'hatenaim, and the conditions, shenidberu, which were spoken, v'hutnu, and agreed upon, bein hani shnei atzadim, between these two sides. Which two sides? The chosn side and the kala side. And then you start filling in names. Hainu, by that I mean, mitzad ha'echad, on one side, Reb so-and-so and so-and-so, whose name has to be filled in. That's the first blank. Next line, ha'omeid mitzad ha'chosn, who represents the chosn, blank, 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 shmero beru. U'mitzad ha'sheni, and from the second side, obviously, Reb so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, ha'omeid mitzad ha'kala ha'psula mara so-and-so, who represents Hakala, the Kala, Abisula, never having been married, Mrs. So-and-so and so-and-so. There is a very important reason for the inclusion of, in this line that I just read, Abisula, never having been married. The reason is simple. Chazal are very hard-pressed to make certain, to emerge with distinction at insisting that in every stage of marriage, the woman's right financially is guaranteed. Some of you may not believe that, but that is the clear and unadulterated truth. The minute the word Habesulah is indicated, the status of never having been married immediately imposes financial obligations, not only in Tanoim, but also in the Kesuba especially, that are double that of a woman who has already been married. Because it is assumed that in a second marriage she already has some kind of knipple, some kind of estate. Do you understand? That's the point. And it is assumed because if she was married once before, there has already been some kind of financial commitment that was made through the first procedure. Now when we get in our next stage, when we get to Kesuba, the one question that you're going to have to ask in our next session is, well, there is a financial obligation for first marriage of Basula, 200 kesef, zuzim kesef, 200 zuz of silver, dollars and cents. What do I have to commit myself to? And the commitment is from the husband to the wife. Upon divorce, she must be paid that. Oh, so I asked you, that's what I'm saying. I asked you to wait till the next session. If you really can't wait, mamish can't say shayisalt. So instead of doing the next session chuppah, I'll do next session get. I'll kind of reverse it. All right. Now there are, and what's more, how is it to be paid? Can it be paid with a life insurance policy and the wife is a beneficiary? Can it be paid with a mutual fund? You understand? Or does it have to be paid like Pidyon HaBen time? The Kohen is given what? 5 shkalim silver, you see. Now clearly in a first marriage, it is double. It is 200, as opposed to any second marriage, for any reason, 100. And it is all predicated on this. There is absolutely no value judgment being made in that word habesula, other than the assumption that the estate that has to be now created has got to be created with that in mind, that she comes first time to a wedding. It is a thing that if explained any other way is a distortion, and if you hear it any differently from any other feminists, tell them please to get a tissue and go blow their nose. Okay? That is it, and there's no fudging over here. So let's continue on. Needless to say, this particular form that I have in front of you would not be used. I would not use it for a second marriage, but I have another form identical to this, leaving out the word habetula. So we come to the second part. Remember, this is Rav Moshe Feinstein's innovation here. This is where he innovates, and this is where some I've heard and still do hear that they scoff and they laugh. It's a joke, a galechta. Asher, specifically, kvar niskayimu kol achiyuvim. All obligations were already taken care of. Niskayimu, they were taken care of, they were done. Mitzad echason lakala, the obligations that the chason had to the kala side. V'chein niskayimu kol achiyuvim, everything was taken care of. Mitzad akala lechason, and from the kala side to the chason's. V'ein lahem ze al ze, one doesn't have to another shum ta'anos utvios, no complaints and no demands. Everything was taken care of. Can you tell me what the everything is? Anything and everything you decided to discuss. And if you didn't decide to discuss, that too. Finish. Aval. Next section. Aval. However, nishar od, there's only one thing that is left. Lehit kayem, that has to be taken care of. Masha chatana now, and that is that the above-mentioned chasan, Yisayas HaKala Anal, will marry the above-mentioned Kala, Bechupa V'Kiddushin, in a Jewish wedding, Kedas Moshe, according to Halacha, the Yisrael, and according to the practice of Jews, B'Yom, on day X, L'Chodesh, of the month X, Shinas, the year, so-and-so-and-so-and-so-and-so-and-so. Finished. And here's the romanticism again. Va'al yavrichu. And by the way, this is not Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe's innovation was only in the second section, and everything was discussed, and everything was taken care of. We agree that everything was taken care of. That's it. Va'al yavrichu. Let them not hide. Va'al ya'alimu. Let them not distort. Lo ze mizo v'lo zo mize. Not from one another. Not him to her and her to him. Shum havrachas momon ba'olam. No deception whatsoever when it deals with money. Ela yishletu b'nichseihon. Let them manage. Yishletu. Shalit is a manager or an emperor, because he's in charge. Yishletu b'nichseihon. Let them be in charge of their estate. Nechasim. Shaveh b'shaveh, 50-50, because that's the way you will build shalom, peace, shalva, serenity. Kederech b'nei Torah, the way people who are educated in Torah do, v'yirei Hashem yisvarach, and those who have awe for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. End of section. Kol zeh, all of the above. Na'aseh b'deah shleima, was done with full knowledge, u'miyushevet, and full consideration. Blank. There's a word there that cannot be filled in until it's actually done. The word is ukinina. Ukinina means, and they shook on it, the Jewish way. You understand, with the handkerchief. You know, like you do sometimes when you empower me to sell your chametz? That's the Jewish handshake. So that people see that there is business between us, something has passed between us. And if you want to know what passed between us, just look at the document that was signed. Ukinina. Min shnei atzdadim, we ask that both sides enter into a kinyan, grab the handkerchief, al kol ma, to attest to everything, the kasuv, that has been written, umefarash, and has been detailed, le'el, above, and we made this kinyan, bimono, with an object, the kosher limiknayobe, that is proper to go ahead and do a kinyan with. You do it with a handkerchief. But it doesn't have to be a handkerchief, because in Sefer Rus, in Megillas Rus, when Boaz took over all of the rights of the family and all of the obligations of the family of Naomi from someone else who was online, before he went ahead and bought these rights by taking off his shoe and handing it to him. And the transfer of a shoe from one to another tells us that it doesn't have to be specifically a shoe. Someone, for instance, I mentioned Mechiras Chometz, someone came to me, and he didn't have a handkerchief, I didn't have a handkerchief, and I should have had one. It was a shotgun kind of a deal, it was going away. So what do you do simply? You take off your yarmulke and you hand it to him, and it's all finished. He said, no problem. Absolutely no problem whatsoever. As long as there is a transference. And this is called a sudar. A sudar is literally a kerchief, but it doesn't have to necessarily mean a sudar, and that is the last line. Bimono, with an object, de kosher lemiknayobe, that is proper to be able to make a kinyan with, and I can go ahead and make a kinyan with a yarmulke, just the way I can do it with a handkerchief or a kerchief. Vehakol, these last three words, everything of the above, sharir, is as clear as could be, vekayam, and shall be truth, to exist as truth, and the two witnesses attest to it by signing. Why the gelechta? Why laughing and scoffing at it? Simply because it says nothing. Tanoim is a legal document. It is a legal document by virtue of the fact that we go ahead and we make a kinyan. It is a legal document by virtue of the fact that you have two witnesses that have to sign. Okay? It says nothing. It says that we just discussed everything, and everything is discussed. And if that's the case, what do you have to write for? Nonetheless, Rav Moshe Feinstein said, there is something to the Tanoim, as he writes it here, if parents or children insist that there be Tanoim, but at the same time, you have all of these taboos about writing things out. For if you want to write Tanoim before, the way it was done from time immemorial, get together 2, 3, 4, 5 months in advance at the Vart, or at the next time that you meet after the Vart, write Tanoim. But if you don't want to write Tanoim in its full, you know, in its full manifestation, but nonetheless for sentimental reasons, you want to go ahead and have Tanoim, here is a Tanoim that, in his opinion, certainly has validity. And that doesn't make the whole procedure into some kind of pro forma joke, because after all, when you read this, though it may not say anything, it does, on the other hand, say everything. That we decided one of the conditions in our relationship as family was to decide that everything between us we'll have orally. Is there no precedent for agreeing on things orally? We do it every single day, we make oral contracts. And the only thing we're doing is the one thing that we can put down without any question, without any fear of it being broken, 99 out of 100 times, is that the chuppah is going to be on the fourth day of Shabbat in the year 5748, and that's it, whatever it is. I'm finished. Do you have to have Tanoim? The answer is no. Are your children or grandchildren tainted for life? Sofek Mamzerim or something like that? You know, no. There is absolutely no such thing. Why? Because this is nothing more than a statement of relationship between families. And that's it. At the end of Tanoim, whether it is style number one, which I will share with you in a moment, style number two, or style number three, doesn't matter. Our minhag is that two ladies, mothers if they exist, or two ladies, family representatives from each side, get together to specifically break a plate. Must it be a plate? The answer is it only has one qualification, and that is that it be kli cheres, that it be china type or pottery type earthenware. It could be anything, it does not have to be a plate, but it has to be earthenware. Some insisted that it already be a chipped utensil, because to go ahead and break a good plate is Baal Tashchis. Most of us have not accepted this, you see, because Baal Tashchis, wanton destruction, is only when there is no reason. There is an intensely important reason to breaking a plate. And it is not wanton, it is not necessarily destructive. Or better still, Mekalkel, when you destroy something, al menas livnos, for the purpose of ultimately rebuilding something better, or trying to show something out of the destruction, then it is not Baal Tashchis, it's not just wanton destruction. The classical example is, you may not know it, and it has nothing to do with chuppah and kiddushin. You know, people, you're not supposed to cut down trees, according to the Holy Book. You have a tree, however, where its branches are over your roof, and it is ruining your roof because of the rodents that get up and jump on your roof and other things, you may cut that tree down, because it is soser, it is destroying al menas nivnos, in order to protect that which is your property. Here too with the plate. A plate, as I said, is earthenware. There is another, the chemical composition, or the approximate chemical composition of this earthenware is identical to the chemical composition of what other utensil? Human being. Ki ofar ato, because you are nothing more than the same compounds of the earth, v'el ofar tashuv. And once you are broken, Elofa Toshu, back to dust. Okay? I'm saying earthenware rather than bone china. Why? Bone china is bone. It's porcelain. It has porcelain to it. All right, but it's ultimately, it's made out of, you start with what? You start with sand. Okay? And here is the symbolism to the breaking of the plate. Things get broken and things get destroyed. If every single thing in the world that we have should be destroyed and be broken, let not the Tzelem Elohim, the divine image of this earthenware, of this Kli Cheres, the human being, be destroyed or tainted by not fulfilling what we decided to agree upon here. The world, the young birds, the lovebirds, can withstand all the disaster in the world of every piece that they own, of everything that they own being totally eradicated, totally crushed. But let there be the human dignity between families in the knowledge that if we are solid, that if we are whole in keeping our commitment, all disasters can be overcome. Nunu, sometimes it's easier to ask for Mashiach to come than to hope and express these hopes so that they be lasting. Now you understand where we began with, you know, that lofty those first two lines of introduction. It's a highly romantic kind of a breaking of a plate. It's a romanticism that says, oy vey, we are looking for the ideal relationship. And you know how hard that is. I don't care how much the children are in love. The psychological factors that are at play in trying to win the loyalties of the new lovebirds are immense. It's not only who's going to come to whom for Shabbos or how many times did you come, but there are all kinds of subtle ways that we will all have to do. Or, you know, we may have been victim of it. But I, you know, those who have victimized are destined to repeat. There are no two ways about it.
Less than a couple did make the commitment.
Of what?
Of whatever the families want.
Well, give me an example.
Going for Shabbos.
Must they? The answer is no.
Yeah,
but what do you mean, does that jeopardize? That jeopardizes that you're going to turn to be a mother-in-law, you'll hate your daughter-in-law for the rest of your life. Okay, so? You understand? You see, but let me give you a serious answer to this. We are not pie-eyed, Pollyannish kind of individuals trying to write a fairy tale over here. We are all human beings. The Gemara knew precisely. You know, when we talk about divorce, there are certain grounds for instant divorce. No reconciliation, nothing. Boom, ein, zwei, drei. So one of the grounds, we'll learn it, don't worry about it. One of the grounds is if she curses her father-in-law in her husband's presence. Now, when I say curse, that means, you know, you turn to Ribbono Shel Olam, Ribbono Shel Olam, strike this old man down. He should grow like a tzibbele with kappen dreiden the fisarof, right? And he shouldn't have more than one tooth left in his mouth, and that tooth he should have a toothache for the whole life, for his whole life. You understand all of the, you know, the classical repertoire, okay? That you should go up to the Empire State Building and just then a Concorde jet should crash right into you, right? All of these crazy. Did you hear though what the Mishnah said? Cursing who? Father-in-law. What's with the mother-in-law? And the Gemara explains, we know psychologically that when a man is being torn apart by two women, fighting for the love of his wife and at the same time trying to break away from the apron strings of his mother, that if the daughter-in-law will curse the mother-in-law, you can understand. It's only natural. It's only normal. All right? You hear that? Now, did I give you license to go out and haul off at your mother's-in-law right now? You're off the wall. But what the Mishnah already has set down in writing better than 1,600 years ago is that, come on, I mean, you don't have to wait for our friend Freud to tell you that this is the situation. You got this guy, and at the chuppah, this gal who is now the new apple of his life has surrounded him seven times in a new stage of creation, right? You carried him for 9 months. You changed his diapers. Vomiting, he vomited on you. 105 fever, you were up with him, right? When it came to him walking, you were the one who comforted him. And when he had to, and we had to get crazy because he, in school he was, he had a final or he wasn't doing so good or whatever, you suffered with him. Ulcers you got from your son. And now comes this little chick and, you know, and just, that's all finished. Like you never existed before. Now, you understand what I'm saying? So it's a matter. You hit. I mean, what?
I'm glad you're talking to her.
That's what. I don't get you. Why? Look. Now, the reason being is that she may be closer to being her mother-in-law than you. That's all. So she needs it first. That's it. Now, I'll tell you what, Marion. Tomorrow morning, call Leah and discuss it. She has a script already. All right? She'll give you a script. She's got a drawer full for all her grandchildren. But boy, does she have a pocket full for all of her daughters-in-law. All right? It's only natural. And you don't have to worry about Freud. Simple as that.
I remember signing it. Why didn't I sign it?
Excellent.
Your parents have signed it twice.
Excellent. Excellent.
But also, even if it's...